Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today my guest is author Suzanne Woods Fisher, and she is here to talk about her new novel, For the Love of Dogs. So in no particular order, Suzanne Woods Fisher is a wife, a mother, a writer, a lifelong student of the Bible, a raiser of puppies for Guide Dogs for the Blind, a gardener, and a cook. A former contributing editor to Christian Parenting Today magazine, Suzanne's work has appeared in many magazines. Her first novel, Copper Star, a World War II love story, received 3 literary awards. And since then, she has published 3 more books and has 4 books under contract. And you can find Suzanne online at suzannewoodsfisher.com. So thank you so much for joining us today, Suzanne. Hello, and welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Thanks for tuning in again. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today my guest is author Suzanne Woods Fisher, and she is here to talk about her new book, a novel that's just hit shelves called For the Love of Dogs. And in no particular order, Suzanne Woods Fisher is a wife, a mother, a writer, a lifelong student of the Bible.
Thank you so much for having me this morning, Juanita.
Well, I want to congratulate you on publishing what really sounds to be your 4th book.
Yes. Yes, it is, with 4 coming. So it's exciting. It's on a roll, and it's a few years ago I decided to switch from magazine writing to books and decided to go all out for at least a year and see where I was at the end of that year. And it just has been an incredible journey. I just can't go back. I love what I'm doing. I enjoyed the whole process. The ideas keep coming, and fortunately, the opportunities as well.
Well, what actually prompted you to go from magazine writing, and how long were you actually, how many years were you writing for magazines? And then, so what prompted you into writing books?
Well, I worked on the college newspaper and got out of college and had a job at an ad agency and then started a family after I married. And we were transferred quite a bit, and so I was able to continue freelance writing through all these different corporate transfers, including one overseas. We lived in Hong Kong for 4 years, and this was just as the Internet was developing. So I was able to type and work out of our 44-story high-rise overlooking the South China Sea.
Wow.
And just with a click of a button, send these articles that were mostly about parenting, mostly about raising a family, working out problems or thoughts or issues that were going on that were relevant to family living. But with a click of a button, those articles went all the way back to Chicago, Illinois, and I was able to continue writing, always nonfiction, always as a magazine writer.
When was that?
That was 1996, the year of the handover, to 2000, were the years we were in Hong Kong. So we came back from Hong Kong, and it was an abrupt move. We didn't realize we were being transferred. It was a sudden transfer, which is really typical in the business community where you don't have a lot of warning. And I was back in California where I live, and I found I couldn't write. I was sort of blocked a little bit.
Oh, wow.
I had a daughter who was a senior. We hadn't expected to transfer a child at that age to have her senior year uprooted, and everyone would avoid that. I would highly recommend avoiding that, but we just were in a situation where we couldn't do anything about that. And my dad, at the same time, my parents live about an hour away, and my dad had a little bit of that tip-of-the-tongue-itis that was getting more and more obvious. And then all of a sudden, he kept referring to these windfalls. He was going to get a windfall, and something just wasn't quite right. My brother stopped by my parents' house one day and found these Western Union telegrams and did a little bit of detective work, found out my dad had been conned by Canadian sweepstakes artists, scammers. And we just had to put this huge break, kind of a financial net around my parents, not knowing what was going on, why it was happening.
Mm.
So back to writing, here I was with a family starting to change, with a daughter getting ready for college, a dad that was starting to show signs what eventually became the first of Alzheimer's, And I found I just wasn't writing. I just couldn't. Maybe life got a little too personal. It just was hard to know where to go. Mm-hmm. And I was given a book by my niece. It's a book that was published in 1938 by Brenda Uhland, U-E-L-A-N-D, called If You Want to Write. And the very first sentence of the book says, "Everyone is talented, original, and has something important to say." That sentence just grabbed me. And the more I mulled it over, the more I realized that the idea of writing a book, of maybe jumping from nonfiction to fiction, the only one stopping me was me.
Mm-hmm.
So for 4.5 months, I worked on our old antediluvian computer in a tiny, cramped laundry room.
Oh, my gosh.
And I didn't tell anybody that I was writing a novel. I didn't tell my husband. I didn't tell my children. I don't know if, again, it was just a personal journey, but I just thought, I want to keep this private for now, and let me see what I can do.
And that was Copper Star?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of 4.5 months, I had that first draft, which is, a first draft is awful. I mean, it's awful, but it's there. It's at least the bones of the story are there.
Something to work with.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And at dinner that night, I told my family that I had written a novel. And the response from my sons was, "That's why there's no food in this house."
Oh, my gosh.
Which was true. For 4.5 months, everything really had dropped down. I think, I'm not even a big spender, but I think even my Visa bill was hardly anything.
Were they wondering what happened to Mom?
Yeah, but they're, you know, typical teenagers. They were not at all interested in that. It was more, how did it disrupt their life?
Yeah, right.
But with that came the first draft, and I started having my first readers help me out with it and show me errors and places that it needed improvement. And then I just started the process of sending it out, and you get tons of rejection. But there was one little publisher. Actually, it even got kind of far in a big publishing house. And even with all the writing credits I had, even with the title of being contributing editor to a magazine, I still didn't have the name. I mean, there's just so much going into the publishing world, and it's a business, and they need to make money. And it's not easy. No one is looking for you in that industry at all. But that's part of being a writer, is figuring out how to have a good, tough skin and persevering. So then a little publisher, a royalty publisher, did offer me a contract, and it was a good, clean contract. It was it's a wonderful little publishing house, small press, and I decided to go ahead and go. And with that was Copper Star, which has won 3 literary awards, which has just been... And it's been a great seller, one of the best sellers for the little publishing house as well.
Oh, that's great. So when you think back to those days when you were writing that first novel and you were somewhat keeping it hidden from anybody, what was going through your heart and your mind at that time? I mean, it sounds to me like it was quite a personal transformation and an important part of your life journey.
I think it was. I think I was probably 46 or 47,
mm-hmm.
and life was changing.
Mm-hmm.
And to go from nonfiction to fiction, in some ways, was just such an exciting thing to do at that time of life,
mm-hmm.
because it's almost opening up a creative door that you just don't have time for. You don't have enough seasoning in your life. It felt as if I have a whole new wind, a fresh wind, for the rest of my life. It's exciting, and I think it's something I like to encourage other people at this time of life. It doesn't have to be writing, but to get in touch with some part of their creative being. It could be cooking, it could be learning a new skill, but it's exciting to feel as if you have the time and the energy to devote to something new.
I have heard that about sort of the late 40s and is into the 50s, that is really, really key into that whole sort of new chapter of your life.
I agree.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, do you have a preference now between fiction and nonfiction?
Well, here's what I find really interesting. I used to think you were one or the other. But the irony is, if you're a nonfiction writer and you jump to fiction, you're taking with it so much credibility. You know how to research.
Mm-hmm.
You know how to chase down facts.
Mm-hmm.
You know how to put something in a historical context. What's interesting, though, is that now as a fiction writer, when I go back to nonfiction, which I have done and will continue to do, my writing is so jazzed up. There's so much color that is given now to nonfiction writing because all of a sudden I can describe a person with much more descriptive detail.
I've never heard that. That is really interesting and really well said. I can imagine with tapping into your imagination in a different creative side when you're writing fiction, it would only enhance your nonfiction.
It does. It works both ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I would really like to encourage people to try both. Don't box yourself in, because it only works to your advantage.
That is great. Now, when did the idea of having spiritual themes in your writing come through? Was that right from the beginning?
Yeah, I think it's always been a significant part of how I see the world. And I do read voraciously. I read all kinds of writing, and I love good writing. But most of what is on the New York Times bestseller list has a dark side.
Mm.
And some of the best writers of our day are right about the underbelly of humanity. So you finish a book, and I don't know if you're a better person for it.
Mm.
It just, I don't know how much we need to keep going into the darkness.
Mm.
And even Oprah's books that she recommends all the time, they're dark books.
Mm.
A lot of abuse, I'm not saying that isn't a part of humanity, but it's not our best side. So I feel as if the genre that I write to is called Christian inspiration. And I think it's just got so much to offer, because this is a whole genre that's kind of exploding. And it just leaves you with a better sense of who you can be, or a sense of seeking God. And in my books, I'm not trying to ever present Christianity in a pat light or make it seem like a formula, but I always want someone to feel a little more interested in God by the end of the book.
Mm-hmm. Is it pretty strong in the Christian faith, or is it more spiritual? Could someone read your books that you know, has a spirituality, may not be Christian, would they relate?
I've heard that over and over, that
mm-hmm.
people of all faith can read my books, that it doesn't whack you on the top of the head
mm-hmm.
with a baseball bat. And I really, that's not my experience with God. I would never, ever want someone to feel excluded or pressured in any way. Most of my characters are seeking, and they're either trying to get past something. For instance, in For the Love of Dogs, the main character is a missionary, a child of a missionary, now an adult,
mm-hmm.
who has parents that were very into being missionaries and very bad at being parents.
Yeah, I think that is kind of typical, isn't
mm-hmm.
it?
It can be.
Yeah.
And it takes this holy sort of a aura about it. So how dare a child ask for more
right.
from a parent when they're doing God's work?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But you end up with a lot of what they call MKs, preacher kids or missionary kids, PKs or MKs, that have a lot of feelings of resentment
yes.
toward God because of being neglected as children.
You know, that's really true. I actually interviewed an author very recently that was a missionary kid, and we talked all about that. And I had never heard that. So it's a really interesting facet of the whole missionary lifestyle.
Though there are many who really are, they're wonderful parents, and they do.
Sure.
I mean, I hope mm-hmm. to... hate to give the good ones injustice.
Oh, no, right.
And it's getting better, too, where kids aren't just sent off to boarding schools and things like that. They're a part of the whole experience of being a mission family,
mm-hmm.
an overseas family.
Mm-hmm. And so you're talking about Samantha. She's a missionary kid?
Yes.
Okay. Well, tell us a little more about Samantha. I mean, this book is very character-based, and Samantha is just an amazing character. She's a blind woman who is going through this process of losing her sight. She is getting a guide dog. So tell us a little bit more about the general storyline. What happened?
Well, you said it perfectly. She is losing her sight and trying to hold on
mm-hmm.
to her independence.
Mm-hmm.
She's a strong person. She has a twin sister and a grandmother who's starting to show signs of Alzheimer's, which you can see the autobiographical
yes.
element in there.
Yes.
So the main person in her life is starting to lose her bearings. And Samantha has been the one who has kind of taken that strong role, and here she's losing her ability. So she's struggling. She's trying to figure out how to be the person she wants to be, run an olive oil company in Northern California in the late 1960s, keep this family together, and yet at the same time lose something so precious as her vision. She has a degenerative disease, so it has been progressively declining.
Mm-hmm.
But she's now about 29 years old and almost completely blind at this point. And in comes this neighbor who wants her to get a guide dog and has kind of that bull in a china shop personality and talks her into it, and her sister sort of pushes her into it, and next thing she knows, she's at a campus called California Canine Academy, where she's learning how to deal with trusting what she really can't see anymore, which is a metaphor for the whole book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really fun book. I mean, I set it in the 1960s because partly it's such an interesting time of life with the moon landing. The first chapter begins, the first page begins, the day of the moon landing. And also the reason I set it, two other reasons. One, I needed to have a little lack of technology. When I first I wrote it in present day,
mm-hmm.
but it was a little too difficult to deal with cell phones, and there's so much technology now for blind people.
Computers, yeah.
Yes,
mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Adaptive computers. And I tried it again. I rewrote it in the 60s, where it actually, the Civil Disabilities Act just came into being in 1968, so it was now a federal law that, for instance, guide dogs were permitted in places, but it still, there was a lot of pressure against it. It wasn't that easy for her to walk on a bus with a dog, for example.
Mm.
And
there's something, even looking back at the 60s now with all the change that was happening, compared to today, there's almost an innocence still in the 60s.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it was fun to even write it because I remembered so many things I'd forgotten.
Like I bet.
A television needed to be tuned up. Do you remember that?
Yeah, right.
You'd have to wait till the tubes would get warm before
mm-hmm.
the picture would come on.
Mm-hmm,
or,
mm-hmm.
or funny things like Tang.
Remember
drinking Tang or just all kinds of parts that made the story more real
mm-hmm.
and gave it more of a setting.
Well, where did the whole idea of writing about Samantha, this whole topic of her losing her sight, I know that you're involved with guide dogs, but where did the idea for this whole storyline come about?
Well, I am involved in guide dogs
mm-hmm.
and I've raised 6 puppies and continue to raise. I love the organization and I kept the people I meet there, the people who are visually impaired who get a dog, they are the most amazing people. I mean, they really want a life. They want their independence. They are not looking to be dependent on anybody. And every person I've met, I just keep feeling as if I'm just amazed at what they can accomplish in their life with, you know, a great limitation as blindness or even visual impairment. So I kept thinking about this story of just a woman going, maybe who was even a little reluctant to go. And I brought in some of the other people. There's an older man there who's actually based on my college president, a man who went blind later in life due to a stress reaction, which I'm not sure medically I can explain it, but
wow.
Had something to do with shutting off blood vessels. And,
mm-hmm.
and this man in the book named Dr. Summers became a bit of a mentor for Samantha because his whole feeling was he was a better person now with his blindness. And when she heard that sentence, she just grabbed it and tried to understand what made him tick. How could he look at blindness like that?
Mm-hmm.
So I interviewed a number of blind people. And one, just to get a real feeling about it, what it was really like, what it looked like for them, what it was like going to the doctor every 6 months to see your vision declining more and more. And
it wouldn't be a scary, scary process.
Yeah, and there's so many different reasons for people going blind. It's not just
and different reactions, I imagine.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing in the book is that Samantha, there's a number of points of view, but Samantha's point of view, I can't use any visual cues.
Oh, well, how did you make that work?
I used a lot of smells. I had spoken to a couple people about how do they do things. For example, it would be different today, but let's go back to the 60s. I interviewed a woman who could help me back then where, for instance, her picking out her clothes, she would have maybe one safety pin on the label for a red dress and 2 for blue and 3 for green. Little tricks
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
that they would use to try to keep their life independent,
mm-hmm.
like a rubber band around chicken noodle soup, 2 rubber bands around vegetable soup. little things like that. They were just really interesting to learn about. So
yeah.
I tried to use a lot of just tactical responses for Samantha.
That's fantastic.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Hi there. Are you looking for new ways to promote your book? Why not consider being interviewed live? With the huge impact internet radio, as well as podcasting, is making in our society, your voice can now be heard worldwide. Let Juanita at Inside Scoop Live create the necessary steps for you. You will not only receive a web page of your own, but your interview will be available for MP3 download and RSS feed. As well, your interview will be posted on venues such as iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, Podcast Alley, and the Inside Scoop Live blog. Go to InsideScoopLive.com today for more information. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm talking today with Suzanne Woods Fisher. She is the author of For the Love of Dogs, and you can find out more at her website, SuzanneWoodsFisher.com. Well, how did you originally get involved with Guide Dogs for the Blind?
Well, that goes back to being in Hong Kong, where we couldn't have a dog, and my youngest son was 8 at the time, and when we moved back from Hong Kong, we had talked about having a dog, but my husband's a not dog guy. I mean, he doesn't dislike them, but he just doesn't see the need for them.
Mm-hmm.
So he told my son, well, if you can find a function, then I'll consider it. And that very week, we went on a field trip to Guide Dogs for the Blind over in San Rafael, California, and we found the function. We found a purpose.
Yeah.
So we came home and told Steve, guess what? Good news. And next thing we knew, we were in the process of becoming puppy raisers, where you go to meetings weekly, go to graduation, you become, someone comes to your home. It's almost like adoption in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And by Christmas of that year, we had our first puppy, a little 8-week-old yellow lab named Arbor.
Oh.
And raised him, and he actually was our first graduate as well. He was with a college student in Kansas City. It was such a wonderful experience. In fact, I've raised 6 dogs, and all 6 are tucked into this book somewhere.
They are.
Yes.
Oh, wow. That's great. Well, how long do you usually have a guide dog?
Usually about 8 weeks,
mm-hmm.
all the way to anywhere around 15 to 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go back to the campus for 6 months of training, 4 to 6 months of training with the real instructors. We have our job to do in socializing a puppy well, getting them used to going places, out in public, good manners, housebreaking. But the real customized work with the blind happens over at the campus.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the dog is trained, in comes the blind person, and they essentially become trained for a month. They stay at the campus for a full month doing everything and learning how to get a dog on an airplane, how to handle problems, how to take care of a dog. There's all kinds of tremendous ways that they help the people be prepared. And then the graduation comes, and the puppy raiser goes back and actually presents the graduate to the, you know, presents the partner to the graduate.
Mm-hmm. That is an amazing process. Do you find it hard to have to give up the puppies?
Whenever we've given a puppy back, we always call ourselves the Schmaltz family, because we do. We cry. Even
oh,
my
do
husband
you?
Cried.
Oh, I imagine.
But it's not like putting a dog down. It's like
yeah.
sending a dog to college.
Yeah.
And you do stay in touch with many families, not everybody, but for us, for example, with Arbor, we get a Christmas card every year, and Arbor's name is imprinted in with the whole family.
Oh.
And he's changed John's life within 24 hours. After they returned back to Kansas after graduating,
mm-hmm.
his mother sent me an email and said, John has taken Arbor on a walk to a friend's house. And she said, I can't remember the last time John felt like he could make that walk.
Wow.
And in some ways, 24 hours later, that loss for us, which it was, because when we said goodbye to Arbor that very last time, we knew we probably wouldn't see him again. But loss turned into gain. And it was just been such a rich experience for us.
And you continue. Do you have a puppy right now?
I'm going to get one this summer.
Oh, good.
I have been doing it in the summers, you know, starting in the summer. But I really can't say enough about the Guide Dog for the Blind. There's so many other organizations, Canine Companions, that are just doing so much for people.
And these are nonprofit?
Completely nonprofit. And their services are free to those people who participate in it.
So you did research with individuals that had guide dogs as well to kind of formulate how you would build this relationship with Samantha and her dog?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I did that, and then I had someone at Guide Dogs read it over, and she came up with, helped me again with some really good points, just specific things so that I would know how an instructor might handle working with Samantha. So I tried as much as I can to be accurate to what the experience would be like.
Absolutely. So I know that trust and balance are very key themes in this book. I'd love for you to talk a little more about your intentions with these messages that you're really putting forth.
Well, I think each story, I feel as if I want someone to read it, as I mentioned, and feel a little more willing to take a step to get to know God in a deeper way. And I'm not trying to push them in my direction. I just feel like open a door. See what's there. Don't be closed to it. See if you can get past some of the blocks in your life. And each book is a standalone. They're sort of a entertaining, good book to read, as you mentioned, very character-based, strong
mm-hmm.
characters.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully they just feel real, feel like people you know. They're flawed. All of them are flawed. And I hope just they are more than entertainment. I hope they leave people with a little sense of just optimism and hope and a sense that they can do more with their life.
Very positive, inspirational writing that you do. I really, really enjoy it.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm really curious to hear where the whole olive oil ranch idea came from for this story.
Well, some of that, I actually spent a day over at McAvoy Olive Oil, which is the premier olive oil that's on the market right now, and went through all the process, the entire start to finish, how the trees are grown, how it's processed into olive oil. But I wanted to pick something that seemed sort of Northern California-ish.
Mm.
And olives, I mean, wine is obviously the main thing. But in a way, I love the idea of olive oil because in 2009 it's getting so much attention. When I set that back in 1969, I might have taken a little liberty because it doesn't have nearly the attention given to it that it does now or the health benefits. But the Spanish missions did have olive oil, and Spanish olive oil has been a huge part of California's history. So even though now people are moving into real gourmet type of olive oil or Italian, Tuscan, which is that green peppery bite, it's still a wonderful part of our history out in California.
Oh, I think that's fascinating. I didn't know about that history. So there we get to learn something there.
Mm-hmm. That's true, and that's my nonfiction part coming out.
Yeah, right. That's
a lot of. Hopefully, it's credible. Hopefully, a lot of the context is very credible.
Yes. Well, and another, you know, we alluded to the whole idea of your own father having Alzheimer's, and you bring that into this book. Tell us a little bit more about how much of your own experience and your father's story is written into this novel. I know that I jumped on your website, and you have a blog post that you put up there recently about your father. I think it's his birthday coming up soon.
You know, this story, the grandmother in this story has much of my dad's personality, just sort of the strong, we can do this. And for a person like that to start to lose their mind, it's really one of the hardest things I think people face. It's a long, long goodbye, and it's a hard one. The story about this grandmother where she was conned in this story, and I don't want to give too much of it away, because there's actually sort of a happy ending to it, at least in financially. And for my parents, there was, too. My parents did end up having to move out of their home after all the Canadian sweepstakes.
So that actually is a true...
Yes.
Part. Oh, that happened to your folks. Wow.
Yeah. It did. And in the 60s, Canadian sweepstakes weren't big like they are now.
Mm-hmm.
And they are scammers. And one of the things I wanted people to be aware of in the book was just pay attention to older people, those you're caring for, because they are so vulnerable.
Yes.
And there are people that just prey on the weak and the vulnerable. Mm. And I don't know how they can live with themselves, but they sell the names to each other. So, and they collect on Western Union. They ask for some front money. They call you and tell you you've won a big award, but we need money to get it through customs. And next thing you know, my dad was wiring up money off of his Equi line all the way up to Canada.
Mm.
And it was just a tragic situation. Mm. So sad. My dad has worked so hard all his life. And
so much stress on the entire family when something like that happens.
Profound.
Yes.
Yeah, the whole family. It's still hard, very, very hard. Mm. So, we put a net around Dad. We're trying to take as good care of him, all my brothers and sisters, as we can. In fact, I dedicated this book to my brothers and sister because we've had to work together. There's one of the blessings that comes out of something like this. We've worked hard together to keep Dad safe. And he's an energetic man and keeps busting out of his facilities. And
oh, he does.
Oh, my gosh. He gets phone calls from the police that he's 20 miles away.
Oh, no.
Oh, it's terrible. But there's a lot of parallel of the grandmother in the story to that, to Dad. And again, set in the 60s, so it was magazine sweepstakes, which were getting popular
mm-hmm.
back in that time.
Mm-hmm.
But it is hard, and my heart goes out to those families. There's so many who are dealing with dementia, and it just so much harder than anyone can imagine to lose somebody, and yet they're still here.
They're still there, and that was something that you had said about the long goodbye. I mean, that really is the experience of it, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. I mentioned in my blog post that it was my dad's birthday, and I couldn't think of a gift because people steal his stuff in the dementia ward, and he's still there. It's part of, you know, Alzheimer's, and yet he's still my dad. You know, he doesn't need anything, and he really shouldn't have anything, and yet he's still here. It's a funny in-between time.
Yeah. How long have you been going through that?
Since we moved back, so 2000 to now,
mm-hmm.
and I think we have a long road ahead. Dad is really healthy,
mm-hmm.
really, really healthy.
Well, if he's found 20 miles away,
I know.
That is incredible.
I know. Yeah, he's fine. We're panicked.
Yeah, right. He's oblivious.
Oh, yeah. And even the policeman scowling at me. It's like, it's not like we're not trying.
Yeah. That is so. Well, you have some upcoming projects this year as well. You are releasing another book in October.
Yes, this is a book called Amish Peace, and it's a nonfiction book by Revelle Baker it has about 30 to 40 stories, true stories of Amish families. It's a really interesting book. I'm really excited about it coming. It's called Amish Peace, Simple Wisdom for a Complicated World.
And so where did the whole idea of writing about Amish people come from?
Mm-hmm. My mother's family is something called the Dunkards, which is part of a German Baptist.
Mm-hmm.
And they all come from the same Anabaptist tradition, right back to the Reformation period. Out of that time frame came a group of people who believed that baptism should be an adult affair, a decision, not infant baptism.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a major schism right there in even the young Protestant church that was developing. And out of that came the Mennonites and the Amish and the German Brethren and Hutterites and others. And my mother was one, her family's roots go back to that. So we have a strong family connection with the Anabaptist tradition to some degree. And it's always sort of intrigued me. I've really enjoyed my extended cousins, and think very highly of them. And so when this book came into being, it was a challenging book because I went back to Pennsylvania and Ohio and I did have contacts, but you're trying to develop relationships with people who do not really want to be found. They are
mm-hmm.
utterly private people.
Yeah.
And it wasn't easy, and yet they have so much that we can learn from. You don't have to go Amish to incorporate some of their beliefs of a less materialistic world of
just good-hearted values.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And there's so many. One small example is whenever they incorporate something new, a technology, and they do. They're not living in a totally outdated world. They just are very deliberate before they accept a new technology.
Yes, I've heard that.
And what they ask themselves is, where will this lead? That's a wonderful question for families to think of.
Wow, that is incredibly powerful. You know, I think that there is a lot of misinformation and stereotyping that goes along with the Amish, you know, so there really is a need for more publications and more information out there about these people that, you know, really are amazing, amazing people.
They are, and I think we get distracted by the buggies and the beards.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But there's so much to learn, and especially when you think of just most family lives are pretty fragmented.
Yes.
And we've got to get a handle on some of this.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, things are kind of spinning down at this
mm-hmm.
point. So you actually have three more books coming out in that whole line.
Well, yes, an Amish Peace is actually nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
But then will come, starting January 1st, a book called The Choice, followed by two other books. And those three books will be our Amish fiction about the Amish, I guess I should say.
Oh, great. So is the Revelle Baker, is that a small press that you're with?
No, actually it's a big Baker Books.
Oh, Baker Books.
Yeah,
okay.
Really big, and Revelle is one of a division. within Baker.
Okay. And so you have had contracts obviously now with big publishers, and you've also worked with small press. Do you have a preference, and what do you recommend for new authors to the path that they should go, you know, and what's realistic for them?
Well, I really have loved the way I've proceeded. I look back now and I found a good small press, which I think is important. I felt like it was going to be around for a long time. It wasn't just something that you weren't sure would be in existence in a year.
Good point.
I did my due diligence. I did homework on it. And yet, with a small press, I mean, it's true. You don't have deep pockets. You don't have a huge support team like I do with Revell. And there is a big difference. I don't deny that. But I have such an appreciation. I know what it's like to promote a book. I have learned skills that I'm not sure I ever would have if I had just gotten lucky the first time.
Yeah.
And I mean, I just feel so not just grateful, but I also feel like I've learned what I need to do to keep your name moving forward, to keep promoting a book well, to partner with your publisher. So in some ways, I really encourage writers to not think you have to go big. You know, the big is the only way to go. I think good things start small.
I think that's a common misconception and really a false expectation for a lot of first-time authors to think they're just going to hit it big with a big publisher right off the bat.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it does happen, but it's pretty rare.
Yeah.
And you can get so discouraged and then derailed. And I sort of feel like one of the best things that's happened to me is starting small and then moving forward. And it is different, though. I mean, you do, Revell Baker, I mean, just yesterday I received the catalog, and I've got a full page in it that's going to be coming out. And I just learned this week also that Walmart has picked up my book for distribution.
Oh, and congratulations.
It's exciting, and that's a lot of working with a large publisher. There's just so much more of a support team working on your book's behalf.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you, I appreciate it, and I'm not sure I would have as great an appreciation if I hadn't started with little books where you're going to bookstores yourself and you're trying to talk to groups and you're, you know, just book by book.
Book by book, exactly. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure that you do get approached by a lot of aspiring authors and first-time authors that are looking to publish their work. So what is some of the advice that you typically give them?
Well, one of it is you do have to take your writing seriously. You have to give it time. You have to give it a goal. Set marks for yourself so you aren't just going on this never-ending perfectionism spiel where you're not going to ever finish the book. But so you do have to take it seriously. But you can't take yourself too seriously. Because there is so much rejection in this industry. There is so much, you're a little bit of a public person, and people forget you have feelings, so you get all kinds of interesting comments. And
lots of criticism.
Lots of criticism, yeah. And lots of wonderful things, too. But
clearly,
you have to be pretty clear that you're doing this for the love of writing. But at the same time, set a goal. Get going, get moving, and see what you can do. But I strongly encourage people to do it, and I love to encourage aspiring writers. I just think it's no group needs more encouragement, I think.
Now, do you go to any book conventions? How involved are you in that whole end of the literary spectrum?
I have done some, and I suspect I'll probably be doing more, but it is such a tough balance between writing and then promoting.
Yes.
It's almost two skill sets, and both are almost full-time. And it's hard. I've had these 4 contracts with Revell Baker, and I have been really pushing to get ahead of deadline, because I always like to work ahead of deadline, and then get them to them and continue my relationship building with them. And because of that, I think promotion drops. I mean, I was hoping to go to a conference, and I just couldn't. I just couldn't stop 5 or 6 days.
Not enough time.
So it is hard.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a tough balance. But at the same time, I think every author does need to partner with a publisher and get out there, and you learn what's being looked at in the industry and what they're wanting, and you just can't learn enough.
And the industry is changing so quickly now with the computer technology that we have that it really is good to connect with someone that, you know, is right there on the front lines and knows what's changing almost on a daily basis.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Even bookstore owners.
Yeah.
Just good to be there. Good. Every time I go in a bookstore, I try to buy something, trying to support them as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very good.
It's more than a full-time job, that's true.
Oh, no kidding. And, you know, a lot of writers do have full-time jobs on top of writing.
I know they do.
I can't even imagine when they sleep.
Yes, I know, especially because, you know, being creative, you can't program that.
Right.
It's hard to say from 10 to midnight I'll be creative. It's.
I know. Such an interesting life. Well, Suzanne, it's been great talking with you.
Thank you, Juanita. You too. You're a wonderful interviewer.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, let's mention your website. It's SuzanneWoodsFisher.com. And what can we find there?
I have there a daily blog that I try to do daily posts to.
Mm-hmm.
Almost all the time I have daily posts.
There's another thing on your list of things to do.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. That takes up a lot of time.
I know it does. Mm-hmm.
But it's important to be fresh, for people to come in and see what kind of a writing style you have, if that works for them.
Mm-hmm.
You can buy my books there. You can email me. You can. It's somewhat entertaining. I mean, it's not serious. There's a lot of lighthearted, fun things. But
I like your American Idol post.
Yes.
You're a big fan.
I know. My vice.
That's great. Well, we'll definitely encourage our listeners to go check out your site. Did you have any final thoughts? I'm looking at the time, and it's just been so fantastic talking with you, but our time has just slipped by, so I'm just going to offer you the last little bit.
Oh, I just thank every reader out there that's willing to read my books. I'm appreciative, and I know your time is valuable, so when you buy or read a book, I just can't tell you how much I appreciate that effort.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Suzanne, and all the best to you.
Thank you, Juanita.
All right. Okay, listeners, that's been Suzanne Woods Fisher, and her new book, For the Love of Dogs, is out now, and you can find out all sorts of information and Suzanne's wonderful blog post at her website, SuzanneWoodsFisher.com. So I want to thank you so much for tuning in and listening to our wonderful interview today. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.